everyone, and welcome to the second episode to be released this weekend, and my interview with J.V. Hilliard. Now, he and I talk multiple instances of magic in this episode, but the one that struck me was J.V.'s two stories of his mother and father and what happened before they passed. His mother suffered from dementia, just like my father is right now, so he and I had much in common around that. Today is my father's birthday, and as I've told others in the last 6 months, he's declined much faster, so it was a joy today to be telling and reminding him of the stories of his life, instead of him telling us. I'm just going to tell one right now. My father did a lot of work overseas, and as my brother reminded us, this totally hilarious story, my father arrived in a country and at the hotel, went up to the concierge and asked to have his $50 bill in American money exchanged for the local currency. It took quite a while, and as he was wondering what was taking so long, all of a sudden, three or four men, each carrying suitcases, came out from a little room in the back of the hotel. And guess what? All those suitcases were the currency that my father had wanted. It's made for a really great family story ever since then. So right now, I'd like to read a poem that is particularly lovely before we get started, in honor of JV's mother and all those who are suffering with memory loss, and all those family members supporting them. From Lay Khan, Zaya Kemp, and Appetite for Miracles. Because there are people in our lives, rare, unexpected people, who don't just walk beside us through life, they witness our lives too. They hold our memories in their DNA. So that when one body forgets, the other is there to push rewind, to cue up the highlights reel on a love story that made it all worth it. Now, JV is going to introduce himself in this episode, but I do want to tell you he's an amazing conversationalist and such an interesting guy. Among many other things, he's an author of a series of books that have won multiple awards, but he's also super down-to-earth and very kind. He's absolutely a Renaissance human who excels in so very much. And all this makes him wonderfully more interesting. So now, my conversation with J.V. Hilliard.
My cousin has two children, they're twins, and the girl of the two is named Abby. And when she was younger, between 2 and 6, 2 and 7, she would have these visitations by this her imaginary friend named Billy. And, you know, of course, you're like, OK, well, what's Billy look like? And she's like, well, Billy rides a white horse and Billy carries a gun and Billy wears a blue shirt and or a blue jacket and things like that. As she got older, the attachment to the imaginary friend kind of went away. But, you know, my uncle swore that things would happen in the house all the time. I would self-describe in a couple of different ways. If you knew me professionally, I'm an entrepreneur. I own several businesses. They range in a variety of ways. Some of them are, as you mentioned, I'm a defense lobbyist. So I do a lot of tech work in DC with tech companies, helping them navigate the government marketplace. But I also own a sports company that focuses on the four major professional sports drafts. So we're in Indianapolis this week for the NFL Combine. And then I also I own Altered Reality Magazine, which is basically a for the love of site that I've created to give back to the writing community. And we focus on speculative fiction. So if you like sci-fi or fantasy or dystopian stuff or gothic or horror or cryptids, like monster kind of stuff, you'll find it there. It's open to all. We've got winners of like pushcart awards all the way down to first time published people. And we have a lot of fun with it. And of course, lastly, I am an author of fantasy adventure novels. That's how I would answer your question. But the real Joe is a little different. The real Joe even though I sound very worldly, I really enjoy being home. I've got a close-knit family. a lot of friends. I played Dungeons and Dragons at, you know, 6 to 10 every Sunday night with the same guys I grew up with in middle school. So, you know, it sounds like I'm a man about town, but, you know, Sundays I'm sitting here, nerding out with my friends on Zoom, doing one of these, playing a D&D game, having a good time with it.
So in other words, you're lazy.
Lazy. I've been described as many things, but lazy is not one of them.
Oh gosh, what don't you do? I was going to say, that's funny. My sister's husband is also a sports agent, so he's at the combine as well right now. It's quite interesting that, you know, it's like this government work seems different than the sports work, seems different from your author, you know, what you write. And it seems like you've managed to really beautifully marry these parts of yourself that someone might look at them and think, how does that even go together? How do those different pieces of a person go together? Because they wouldn't seem like they would. So when you were a kid, you know, what were you thinking as a kid when you were like, this is when I grow up, this is what I want to be? What did you think?
Well, there are equal paths here for all three things I do professionally. When I grew up, I thought I was going to be a congressman. So finding my way through government, my first job out of college was working for a senator on the Armed Services Committee. And I really, really enjoyed that. And from that, I came up with the idea for my first business, which is this defense lobbying business. The nerd in me always wanted me to be an author. But the problem with authorship is it doesn't pay well, especially in the beginning, you know, and very few authors, really can make it more than just a side hustle. And so you have to be successful, and you have to, I treat it in the same way I treat my other businesses, which is, you know, I am the brand, and my books are my product. And so, you know, I sell it in the same way I would market my other businesses. But, you know, the sports stuff I did while I was in college, I played hockey in college. And so I became interested in the scouting industry. And I did some of that as a part-time side hustle when I owned my first business. And then I was able to find and marry up to that another business opportunity. So when I started out by saying I'm an entrepreneur, even though I think I took all three things I was interested in the most and made businesses around them so that I could be involved in them day to day. But, you know, I think if I would put a cap on that, I would just say that maybe I'm a serial entrepreneur, and I just found several opportunities that just happened to be in certain lanes that I knew stuff about.
I see. Well, I think it does take a really special person to kind of recognize opportunity, and it sounds like that's what you've done. But also, not only recognize opportunity, you've learned to kind of be malleable and not just let one occupation, one job, one way of being in the world kind of define you. And I think we need more people like that, more people who are able to see the possibility in things, but also don't allow the box that maybe society constructs for them.
Oh yeah.
To, like, limit opportunity or possibility in their lives.
Yeah, I 100% agree to that. And I'll say this. I mean, if you told someone on Capitol Hill that I wrote fantasy novels or played Dungeons and Dragons at night 20 years beyond when I should be, they'd laugh at you or not believe you. And same thing holds true for the other stuff. When I'm talking at, I'm speaking, you know, a Comic-Con or a convention, and they ask me what I do professionally, and I say I'm a defense lobbyist, they're all looking at me like, wait, what? You know, and it's a right brain, left brain thing, but I'm mentally ambidextrous enough to pull it off, I guess. I don't know why or how it happened, but it worked out that way.
So I have a question. What is the strangest thing you got asked after you told someone you were a defense lobbyist?
So immediately they all think that I'm like a mean-spirited, draconian, you know, I'm, you know, that's bad. I'm involved in all this stuff that's, and meanwhile, you know, I tell people, I liken it to this. I say, you know, if you have to go to court, you get a lawyer. You know, if you go in front of the IRS as for an audit, you get an attorney. And 99% of us lobbyists are just representing the interests of our clients in DC. And the 1% of us that do bad things you know, they sully the reputation of the industry. But that's true for any industry. You can pick sports players. You know, I'm around a bunch of folks over the next 5 days that some of them are going to get in trouble for doing stupid things, right? Or, you know, you could do that in business. You could do that. We've seen it in churches and religion and spirituality. I mean, there's always going to be bad movers anywhere you go. But I think that the presumption is, and I'm buying influence and things like that. And for 99% of us out here, it doesn't work that way. We're just professionals that understand parliamentarian procedures, know how government works, know where funding is. It's not necessarily just one question or one thing that people have said. It's just the generic, it's a generic conversation about it because nobody knows a lobbyist. Unless you live in DC, no one knows lobbyists. You know, we're a dime a dozen in DC, but if you're out in, you know, the rest of America somewhere, you'd be lucky to know one, or you might have heard of somebody. I do less and less of that these days because of my other entrepreneurial endeavors. And frankly, the book stuff is where I want to retire. It's just so much fun, you know, and there's no conflict to it, you know, and that's the other thing I like about that is people genuinely trying to help you with your art form. And I appreciate that.
I'm so curious. Is there a, how many lobbyists does it take to change a light bulb joke?
There isn't one of those. Unfortunately, you know, the correct answer to that was we would all stand around and convince someone else to do it. Right. And that's the way it is because we're supposed to be persuasive people.
Well, my second question always is, did you grow up in a religious household or what did that look like for you as a kid? Did you guys go to the church of D&D or what did that look like?
No, we were Roman Catholic by birth, you know, in the way that went. So in Pittsburgh in particular, the lion's share of, you know, the families here were of middle, like Central European or Eastern European descent. And so this is an amalgam. The city is an amalgam of varying churches from, you know, Greek Orthodox to Russian Orthodox to, you know, Lutherans and, you know, a lot of Roman Catholics. And so when you look at the population that settled here, you know, save for perhaps like the Irish, many of the others were German and Eastern, you know, and you had some Italians. So really German and Austrian and Hungarian kind of back. So, you know, there was some of that was part of the old Holy Roman Empire and things. And so we grew up Catholic and stayed Catholic. But this is one of those cities where if you drive 10 blocks, you're going to see another church that belongs to someone else because of there were pockets of Ukrainians and pockets of Russians and pockets of Poles and pockets of Germans. And so everybody had their own church.
One of my favorite, you know, things and well, I love learning eternally, but I love architecture and the stories that are in architecture. And so thank you for telling me that because I could go to Pittsburgh and have no clue what I was looking at. Yeah. But unless you have someone to tell you those stories, or maybe you're just really gung-ho on history and you buy a book about Pittsburgh and churches, which I'm sure that book must exist.
The churches, there's actually a famous photograph collage of the church doors of Pittsburgh. And I forget the name of the photographer who had done it. And it's probably 20 or 25 years on now, but you see it everywhere here because it's regionally famous, but it was something that was, he went around to all these churches and took pictures of their front doors to capture the history of it because of so many, the clashing and the coming together of so many, like in the American melting pot kind of thing, all of these communities coming together, you know, around these churches. And that's why when I said it's like a lot like Chicago, I meant it. There's these pockets of these neighborhoods that you'll go into. That there's Polish Hill, you know, there's Little Italy. The architecture is stunning. I mean, these are old school artisans who made these churches, you know, and that doesn't predate. I mean, I think the funniest thing about Pittsburgh is the amount of Germans that are here. So of course it's Pittsburgh, but if you rewind the clock, it's actually Pittsburgh. It's like Edinburgh. It was founded by William Pitt, who was Scottish. And so he named it after, or it was named after him. So instead of it being Edinburgh, it was Pittsburgh. And Pittsburgh, when the Germans came here, of course the H stayed, but it's now silent because it's Pittsburgh, right? You know, and that's the way it was. And so the lion's share of the community here that has that, you know, guttural German background, you know, just cannibalized what Pittsburgh once was with the Scots and of course the British, and turned it into, you know, Central Europe.
Yeah, I was going to ask, with that being said, what's your favorite kind of Pittsburghian food?
So there are a number of those kind of things, right? And there's an eclectic, you have to have an eclectic palate to live here, because a lot of people don't know what a pierogi is. You know, there are gyros, but here we call them gyros. But the most famous local, food is a Permanti sandwich. And we say Permantis, we don't say Permontis, like every other Italian place would. It's Permantis because you're in Pittsburgh. And a Permanti sandwich was made for steel workers that had a 30-minute lunch window. And they would walk out of the mills across the street into bars and restaurants and have a quick lunch before their lunch break. And so they didn't have time just for a sit-down meal. So someone said, we're going to take two pieces of very thick bread, Mancini bread here, because Mancini made all the bread for Permanis, and they would put the meat on the burger, or put the meat on the sandwich, throw your French fries on it, and then throw a vinegar-based coleslaw, which is very Eastern European, smash it together into a sandwich with tomatoes, and you would eat it all at one time because you didn't have enough time to go back. So every city has something like that. I know there's Skyline Chili in Cincinnati, and Deep Dish Pizza in Chicago, and Detroit style pizza there, and you know, New York has an eclectic mix. If you come to Pittsburgh, you're definitely using Heinz ketchup. You're going to eat a pierogi. I'm saying that now instead of saying pierogi. It's you're going to eat a pierogi. And if you don't know what that is, Google it. I'm not going to tell you. You could find it on your own. And then of course, Permanti sandwich is like the day one thing that everybody that comes here says, what am I supposed to eat? I know there's something here I'm supposed to try. And it's not for everybody, but you know, for here, it's a way of being able to smash in your steelworker heritage with a pretty tasty sandwich. If you like that kind of Italian deli style serving.
Okay, good God, that sandwich sounds sloppy and delicious.
Sloppy. It is sloppy and delicious, and you will not leave hungry.
Well, Heinz ketchup is delicious, I think, personally.
It is. Everything else is living in denial.
Sorry,
Hunts. Yeah.
I was going to ask you, I mean, obviously we've just been talking about food, but I'd love to ask you, what's one of your favorite things about Pittsburgh that you love the most?
So for me, it's the people. Everybody here has a very similar background. There's no one here that was born silver spoony. There are places in here that clearly have silver spoons. There's no doubt the industrialists here, the Carnegies, the Mellons, the Phippses, they have made the city what it is. And at one time it was the fourth largest city, but you know, it's funny how, you know, there's so much history here, and you can find it going back to the French and American War. Just south of the city, there's Washington, PA, where Washington had his grist mill, and they were debating whether or not this would be the capital because he owned property here, as opposed to Washington, D.C. You get the history of the Industrial Revolution, and of course, you know, service here. You get a lot of folks, number one place in the country for veterans. You'll find people here because a lot of people serve. And I think you can go anywhere and feel safe here, in the sense that if you walked up to a door and your tire was flat, someone's going to try to help you out. And I know that's Midwestern. That's why I like it here the most.
You know, the main thrust of this podcast, the main little nugget of it, or big nugget, depending, is just I ask every guest, I'd love to hear a story or for you to share a story or stories of anything in your life that's happened that you thought you've considered to be magical or miraculous, something that changed your life, maybe something that made you reconsider what it means to kind of be alive or in this body. I'd love to hear anything you'd like to share.
Yeah. So I have plenty of that, right? So I am I don't know where this is going to go, but I'll start with a few things. I've always thought that there are moments in your life that stay with you for whatever reason. And I've always thought that a good autobiography for me would be the string of quotes of things that have happened from people that affected me in their life, right? So, for example, my dad, about 20 years ago, my brother and I were still, you know, high school, college, he got cancer and passed away. And like, he looked at me and said, "My wife, okay." And I interpreted that as saying, he's telling me to take care of my mom, right? But he couldn't, mouth the words. But things like that, and you're like, whoa, and it settles in when he said it. You're like, at the moment, I'm like, yeah, I'm going to take care of her, I'm going to take care of her. Like 2 weeks later, I'm like, wow, that really meant something. And it sticks with me. Or, when you think you've seen a ghost, those kind of things are a little weird. Now, I have never seen a ghost, but I will say this. My cousin, when they were younger, they live about a half a block from a cemetery, and not even that, it's catty corner to a cemetery. And my cousin has two children, they're twins, and the girl of the two is named Abby. And when she was younger, for between 2 and 6, 2 and 7, she would have these visitations by this her imaginary friend named Billy. And, of course you're like, okay, well, what's Billy look like? And she's like, well, Billy rides a white horse, and Billy carries a gun, and Billy wears a blue shirt or a blue jacket and things like that. As she got older, the attachment to the imaginary friend kind of went away. But my uncle swore that things would happen in the house all the time, right? Like these magical things that would happen where stuff would disappear, stuff would get replaced. There's no way it would have moved, but then it did, all that other kind of stuff. And so they decided to do one of these little ghost things where you catch them on recorder, electronic voice phenomenon, right? That's what it's called. They started doing it and they captured these voices, and it prompted them to go visit the cemetery because she would say, Billy lives there. Billy lives across the street. Billy lives there. And went over. And of course, on the hill where we live, there was a Union and Civil War battle. And the first graves in that cemetery were Union soldiers and this like crazy woman that fought with the Union and stuff like that. And lo and behold, there was a cavalryman whose name was William, who fought for the Union, who had died there. So horse, blue shirt, William, Billy, home. It was like that kind of stuff. Like it just creeps you out, right? Right. And about the last thing I'll say is, and it's a touching one, like 2 weeks ago, my mom passed away. 3 weeks ago now. But we knew for a long time, she was really deep into dementia. And there was this point where you could not talk to her. She was almost to the point of like being animalistic in the sense where she was eating ears off fluffy toys and trying to eat plastic. And that was her way of showing that she was hungry and stuff like that. But at the end, the very last day that I saw her before she passed, she pulled it together just to cry. It was almost her way of saying goodbye. And it's like, whoa, when that hits you, you're like, oh. And I told my brother about it. And he's like, she did the same thing to me. And then you celebrate that afterwards. You look at it and there's just like all those little weird things. And like you said, magical. You said things that'll remember, things that like hang with you. Head hangs.
Yeah. And I'm so sorry about your mother.
It was a blessing. It was a blessing. She was so far gone.
Yeah. Oh, I don't, my father has dementia and he's had it for quite a few years and it has been progressing slowly, but since last November to now, I've really noticed that he's diminished a lot quicker than the previous, let's say, 5 years. It just seems to have sped up quite a bit. And I'm not sure what's caused that, but I do look at it and wonder, where are we going with this? Because it doesn't look like a pretty place. It doesn't look like a place that I'd ever want my father to be in. And so, and also like a really, vulnerable and scary place for him, And so, and also like, thank you for sharing, because that's not an easy story to share.
No, and I'll say they have cliffs, right? So they'll level out for a while and then they'll fall off another cliff. And my mom was a patient she was a nurse for patients with Alzheimer's for over 30 years. And so she dealt with it and knew what was coming. she didn't know before they diagnosed. She thought she was just getting forgetful, a little older or whatever. And then all of a sudden she was unaware, right? It was like a magical switch went off. So she didn't know what was coming. But it's a horrible disease. It's the longest goodbye you'll ever have. I mean, she started it 7 years ago. And I wouldn't wish it on my worst enemy. It is a rough thing to see as they go through that. Each stage gets worse and worse. And it's a mercy, you know, that she passed. So I'll put it that way.
Well, I certainly understand that. And I mean, bless her heart for working with people with Alzheimer's, because that's you've
got. Oh, it's tough. The patience you have for that is incredible. And not everybody can do that, right? Like, I couldn't do that. I'm a scumbag lobbyist, right? And she's like, I can't do what you do. I don't expect you to do what I do. It's a blessing, right? Some people find that and they've got that and other people don't.
Thank you for sharing those stories.
My pleasure.
One about Billy and...
Crazy. It's so true. It's so true. It freaks me out because, like, you could hear a voice in the attic and there's no way there's a voice that's going to be there. And it was two women talking on a audio recorder. And it was clearly a male voice and there was no one else in the house. And it answered their question clear as a bell. And then, like, the clues are just like, and if you believe in that stuff, you're like, well, it scares you. You know, if you're a skeptic, I get it. I truly do. But it's something you shake your head and you're like, I don't know. Is that really happening? Did that just happen? And they're kids, like, they're not going to know any better. So they're just telling you, my friend's here to visit. And that's what they look like. And, you know, his name's Billy. And, you know, he has a horse. And, like, you go over there and you see a cavalryman's grave. With the name William, it's like, how did she get that, right? At 2, at 4, at 6.
Well, I think it's really fascinating because a lot of those young men were boys. They were boys. They were, in essence, kids who were fighting. You know, it wouldn't surprise me if some of them afterwards, after they passed away, they're like, you know what? I never got to actually grow up and play and have fun. So there's someone who can see me. Now I have someone to hang out with, you know.
Yeah, we're going to stick around for a while, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I've had some other people have told stories like that. And it's always interesting. Some children can see those ghosts, those people who have died. And I think they just gravitate towards kids that maybe they think, oh, I can make a connection here. I'm not going to be lonely anymore, you know, or we could say maybe all kids have the capacity or the ability. We just don't all live kitty corner from a graveyard. So,
yeah. And I think part of that is, from what I understand, theoretically, is that kids are closest to them. You know, the idea is, you know, they're all in heaven in some way, and one of them crossed over and they're nearest to them, so they're easy to see them. Also, they may be a little bit more open-minded to those kind of things. And so where we as adults shut that down and like, that's not real, they don't know that it's not real. And who knows? You know, I've seen enough psychics in my day, some of them a lot better than others. But it's fun to dabble in it and check it out. And you know, when you get an experience that hits you like that, it stays with you. You asked for magical. That was my magic moment.
And I do have to say that part of the problem, I think, with the adults not seeing these things, or most of us, is because we've probably seen the movie Poltergeist and we're like, what's in the closet? Like, we don't want, like, I know there's something in the closet, even though we can't. And we're just like so shut down. And, or even like, what's that giant thing that looks like a spider, but it's like way too big? You know, I can't squash that thing or whatever. Why is all this jewelry falling out of the ceiling? Like, we have to answer those questions. So we shut it down. That movie probably helped shut down a generation of people who might have otherwise been able to see.
And it made people afraid of clowns. Those clown dolls, it is a source of fear and phobia for many in that generation, I am certain.
so very much to listening to this second episode this weekend. And please do check out the show notes for a link to JV's website. All the good stuff on his website is worth looking at and checking out. I need to thank him for telling me all of his stories, but in particular, telling me the stories of his parents. And once again, here we have a story of a child who can talk to ghosts, or maybe has an imaginary friend that is suspiciously like someone down the road in the graveyard. Well, I did a little research, and I found an explanation on Thought Catalog. Here's the explanation. You can take it or leave it. Children function at a higher level of consciousness than their adult counterparts, at an expanded level of consciousness. It is one that is closer to God consciousness, closer to the divine and to the spiritual realm. Over time, as they age, their consciousness will contract, and many of them will lose these abilities and gifts due to societal programming and trauma. I wish we could all see with the eyes of children. It would make the world a way more fun place. And speaking of fun, starting with the last episode, I'm going to be including a link to something I consider to be beautiful every single episode in the show notes. So yesterday's episode with Elizabeth, there's a sweet little link to an octopus dreaming. So if you want to dip your toe into a bit more beauty, click on the link there and prepare to be inspired. Thank you for listening. And here's my one request. Be like JV. Don't live in the box people create for you. You want to bake bread? Maybe open a bread shop? Do it. Or create pottery? Take a class. You want to write poetry? Do it and self-publish. You are not your occupations, but you are your dreams. So what are you dreaming about? Think about it, then make an action plan, and then do it. Live into your dreams.